6.
Radio Borders Youth Association. Good afternoon, everyone. You are listening to the sound of universal compassion. Today is 26th of March. We will continue listening to Tenton's previous program with the book Way of Life by Shanti Davies. And please enjoy.
This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3 or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146 Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271 3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering. Hello. His Holiness the Dalai Lama often says that the verse he most likes to reflect on daily is, "For as long as space remains, and as long as sentient beings remain, until then may I too remain to dispel the suffering of all beings." Think on this, he says, and immediately you will find a deep peace within your mind. Of course, dispelling all the suffering of all beings is a task so huge that it's practically unimaginable. We can hardly envision all the various creatures on earth, never mind all throughout space and time. However, it is the shift of focus that makes all the difference. Normally, our focus is me, with a capital M. Our innate belief seems to be that as long as I look after myself first, I'll be okay. If I put others first, surely I will suffer. I will lose out. People will take advantage of me. I will always be at the back of the queue, and so on. Therefore, we think, I must put myself first and others can come later. This does, of course, bring some satisfaction and avert some of our problems. But, His Holiness says, even animals are quite good at making this kind of mindset their motivation, though it doesn't solve their problems. In fact, in the long run, it brings many more difficulties. On a merely mundane level, focusing on ourselves, we very often find ourselves worrying. We wonder how we appear to others. We fret about our health, our precious possessions, or whether our partner is cheating on us, and so on. When there's a strong sense of self, there's a strong basis for worry, and the level of uncertainty in our lives causes a kind of constant background angst. His Holiness implies that when we focus on the plight of others, that tension is relieved, and the more we can build a strong concern for others and a lesser concern for ourselves, the less tension we will experience, and hence a deeper peace. And bodhicitta, the mind that wishes to gain enlightenment, for that is the best way to benefit others both temporarily and ultimately, is 100,000 times better at attracting the conditions for happiness and averting the conditions for suffering than a self-centered attitude. As Shanti Davis says in Guide to a Bodhisattva's Way of Life, the text we've been going through over the last few months, bodhicitta is the universal bridge that leads to freedom from unhappy states of birth. It is the dawning moon of the mind that dispels the torment of disturbing conceptions. With its focus on all living beings, bodhicitta, he says, is a universal bridge, a bridge for everyone in all the universes to use to pass over the hell, preta, and animal realms and onto the states of happiness. The dawning moon of the mind refers to great compassion, and the disturbing conceptions are, of course, all the turbulent emotions that bring us so much torment. We got up to this verse in our last program. If you were with us, you may remember the two preceding stanzas. It is the supreme ambrosia that overcomes the sovereignty of death. It is the inexhaustible treasure that eliminates all poverty in the world. It is the supreme medicine that quells the world's disease. It is the tree that shelters all beings wandering and tired on the path of conditioned existence. Pretty powerful claims, don't you think? But His Holiness points out that as we move through the various rebirths in cyclic existence, we are continually tormented by karma and afflictive emotions. In fact, we are reborn precisely because we are driven by karma and afflictive emotions. Therefore, it's not uncommon to find ourselves poor and destitute. with a diseased body or mind, or so scorned we land up without any friends and companions. These make the self-centered mind extremely unhappy. However, the more we are focused on the suffering of others and relieving their pain, the smaller our problems seem to be, and so, almost paradoxically, our suffering is much less. Then, of course, if we can actually bring some relief to others, we inevitably experience a lot of satisfaction and happiness, even if it is just seeing the lifting of misery from their faces. Now, before we go any further in the program, let's set our motivation as we usually do. As we are contemplating the benefits of bodhicitta, let's make our sole motivation for this program the wish to attain enlightenment, so that we can be the best help to others, and especially lead them to enlightenment. With our understanding of Shantideva's verses, this is surely the best motivation we can have. Thank you. And then, just to prove how extraordinary such a motivation is, Shantideva goes on in his next verse to say, "It is the great sun that finally removes the misty ignorance of the world. It is the quintessential butter from the churning of the milk of Dharma." Of course, the true remedy for ignorance in our world is the wisdom perceiving the nature of reality. We see reality in one way, but it exists in a quite different fashion. At the moment, I'm reading a book called A Universe from Nothing by a renowned cosmologist and physicist, Dr. Lawrence Krauss, the foundation professor and director of the Origins Project at Arizona State University. He talks about how current cosmological research points to all material originating in what he calls quantum fluctuations. This is how he puts it. "If inflation indeed is responsible for all the small fluctuations in the density of matter and radiation that would later result in the gravitational collapse of matter into galaxies and stars and planets and people, then it can truly be said that we are all here today because of quantum fluctuations in what is essentially nothing." This is so remarkable, I want to stress it again. Quantum fluctuations, which otherwise would have been completely invisible, get frozen by inflation and emerge afterwards as density fluctuations that produce everything we can see. If we are all stardust, as I have written, it is also true, if inflation happened, that we all literally emerged from quantum nothingness. Now, to say that I completely know what Dr. Krauss is talking about would be a lie, but my understanding is that some quantum particles can come into existence out of nothing, provided they have an extremely short lifespan. This is one of the weirdnesses of quantum mechanics. Space, though appearing empty, is full of such particles. Meanwhile, although the universe is expanding at an increasingly rapid rate, the background energy remains constant, with only minute fluctuations due to these appearing out of nothing quantum particles. However, it is these fluctuations that are frozen by inflation or the expansion of the universe and result in density fluctuations that form everything we experience. In other words, we appear out of nothing, as the doctor puts it. Now contrast this with our habitual view of the solid world filled with independent entities and the Buddhist view of emptiness in which nothing exists from its own side, but is a composite of other things, causes and conditions. We begin, perhaps, to get a sense that our instinctive grasp at independent reality is at least shaky. It is by understanding the true nature of reality, even perhaps approaching it from the point of view of quantum fluctuations out of nothing, that destroys our instinctive ignorance. However, as you probably know, there's a gradation of ignorance in Buddhist philosophy. We have ordinary ignorance, in which, for example, we don't know how a car engine works. We have ignorance, in which we think the Buddhist teachings are mistaken. We have ignorance of the nature of reality. And we have the ignorance that obscures the final liberation of realizing all that can be known. Shantideva's misty ignorance of the world refers to this last ignorance. For it is the wisdom realizing the nature of reality, coupled with bodhicitta, that clears the final subtle plasma between our consciousness and the totality of knowledge. In Buddhism, we call that plasma the obscuration to omniscience. In a more mundane sense, His Holiness says that in ordinary life, with our attachment and aversion, we tend to exaggerate the qualities of objects. A famous example that springs to my mind is the intense emotional attachment that British football fans have for their respective clubs. If the media is to be believed, it's as though life sometimes depended on the performance of clubs or the rivalry between them. But we all have intense likes and dislikes, in which we tend to make more of the thing than is actually there. With bodhicitta, we're much more aware and avoid this kind of reaction, says His Holiness, and so we act with greater sanity, a better understanding of reality in the world. In fact, bodhicitta is so important to Shantideva that he calls it the quintessential butter from the churning of Dharma. That means if you extract the essence of the Dharma, you would get bodhicitta. Pema Chodron goes further and says that the richness of bodhicitta is like the best of butters. Then in verse 33, the penultimate verse of this chapter that we're studying, Shantideva writes, "For all those traveling on the path of conditioned existence who wish to experience the bounties of happiness, this will satisfy them with joy and actually place them in supreme bliss." Now, the path of conditioned existence here refers to our kind of existence under the sway of conditions and causes. We think we are in control, but are almost entirely governed by the conditioning that we have unthinkingly accepted and now almost instinctively act out and assume is right. However, under the guise of giving us happiness, that conditioning inevitably leads us towards dissatisfaction and suffering. If we focus on bodhicitta instead, says Shantideva, we will be assured of all the happiness we wish for, even up to the supreme bliss of Buddhahood. Our fulfillment is so close at hand, says Pema Chodron. We can awaken bodhicitta with our every thought, word, and action. We have a wealth of instructions, more than we can ever use, for finding this supreme bliss that's right in front of our noses. And then she says, in his last stanza of the chapter, Shantideva exhorts us to fulfill our birthright, which is full enlightenment. And until then, he wishes us every earthly joy, all the helpful circumstances we need to relax and enjoy our journey to that enlightened state. He writes, "Today, in the presence of all the protectors, I invite the world to be guests at a festival of temporary and ultimate delight. May gods, anti-gods, and all be joyful." And that ends the third chapter in Shantideva's text, the chapter that Stephen Batchelor, in his translation, heads Full Acceptance of the Awakening Mind. Then Shantideva goes on in the next chapter to explain the need for conscientiousness, or what Pema Chodron calls attentiveness, when we are considering developing bodhicitta. In fact, she said it's like walking on the edge of a steep cliff. We have to be attentive when bodhicitta first arises to our minds, before we decide to make a commitment to it, after making the commitment, and when seduced by afflictive emotions, the results of karma. Kleshas, that is the afflictive emotions or neuroses, she writes, arise with a subtle tension inherent in dualistic perception. If we don't catch this tension, it sets off a chain reaction of for or against. These reactions quickly escalate, resulting in full-blown aggression, craving, ignorance, jealousy, envy, and pride. In other words, full-blown misery for ourselves and others. Kleshas survive ignorance, ignorance of their substantial nature and the way we reinforce them. And they are fueled by thoughts. That their power can be diffused by attentiveness is the main theme of chapter 4. Pema Chodron points out that most people want a better world and to become free of their neurotic habits and mental unease. And this is a good basis for bodhicitta, even though few people think in terms of enlightenment. But if we want a better world, we must act more sanely and not give in so easily to our habitual patterns and emotions. We have to recognize our reactive habits and work with them with intelligence and compassion. Even though we will continue to harm others because we are not yet Buddhas or Bodhisattvas, we can have an ongoing and strong intention to sort out our confusion, as she puts it, and to be of service to others. Chapter 4 starts ensuring that once we've taken the commitment, we don't let it degenerate. It is important to keep our youthful curiosity alive and not become more and more shut down and rigid as we grow older. Even as we age, we must have the intention to keep learning, to keep growing. Having firmly seized the awakening mind in this way, a conqueror's son must never waver. Always should he exert himself to never stray from his practice. Well, once we've taken on something, if we don't pay attention and get careless, we can make a hash of it. And so it is with bodhicitta, once it has arisen in us. As the heading to the chapter implies, we have to keep attentive to the vow and the practices that go with bodhicitta. That is mainly the six perfections of generosity, morality, patience, enthusiasm, concentration, and wisdom. In the case of reckless actions or of deeds not well considered, although a promise may have been made, it is fit to reconsider whether I should do them or not. Now, of course, we should always consider our actions carefully before doing them, but sometimes we are forced into situations in which we agree to act without much forethought. However, even if we make a promise, it is better to take time to carefully consider all the consequences before we actually act. If we find it would be better to abandon the intended action, then, promise or not, we should not go ahead. However, if we decide to act, no further doubts are necessary and we shouldn't look back. This is the gist of this stanza. But how can I ever withdraw from what has been examined by the great wisdom of the Buddhas and their sons, and even many times by me myself? His Holiness teaches here that from the point of view and analysis of all the Buddhas and Bodhisattvas, no other practice surpasses bodhicitta. This is a common theme in Tibetan Buddhism. We can supplement this with our own analysis to also reach this conclusion. And once we've done that, it will be difficult to stray from the practice after we've made the commitment. Pema Chodron says that if we're not sure about making a commitment, it's a good idea to seek advice or inspiration from highly qualified teachers. Here, Shantideva says that he considered carefully before taking the bodhisattva vow, and now will never withdraw from it. If, having made such a promise, I do not put it into action, then by deceiving every living being, what kind of rebirth shall I take? If it has been taught by the Buddha that he who does not give away the smallest thing he once intended to give will take rebirth as a hungry ghost, then if I should deceive all beings after having sincerely invited them to the unsurpassable bliss, shall I take a happy rebirth? As Pema Chodron points out, if we have an impulse to give but don't yield to it, we strengthen the hungry ghost mind of insatiable neediness within us, even if the thing that we want to give is a single chocolate truffle. The karmic result could be painful for us in the future. If that is so for something so trivial, what Shantideva asks would be the consequence of taking the bodhisattva vow to benefit all beings in the best way possible and then going back on it. It's like promising every single being in all the universes that you will save them from all their misery and then not doing what you promised. The karmic result could be very severe. However, Pema Chodron points out once again that we are not perfect and we will not always be able to keep the commitments perfectly. We should expect the temporary lapses from time to time. However, we mustn't let the flame of bodhicitta go out completely and repress our appetite for challenge and growth. We mustn't get to the point of sitting back and saying, "Ah, no, you can't teach an old dog like me new tricks." Our greatest disappointment would be to close our mind to the suffering that is all around us. That may appear to give us a temporary respite, but it really hinders our growth, and we become stultified, like a dead old tree that will never again produce a green leaf or even a tiny bud. Only the omniscient can discern the manner of the action of those who give up the awakening mind but are freed. It is beyond the scope of ordinary thought, writes Shantideva. Now, in the previous verses, he implies that if we give up bodhicitta, we will have difficulty finding another happy rebirth. But in a life before he met Shakyamuni Buddha, Shariputra made extensive offerings to the Buddhas and took the bodhisattva vow. Then one day, some troublemaker came along and demanded he give him his arm. I understand that there's some kind of zombie apocalypse going on in some sections of the younger generation today, and perhaps it was something like that, but more real. Anyway, Shariputra, as he was then, chopped off his arm and gave it to the zombie. However, the zombie then said, I didn't want that arm, I wanted the other arm. Give it to me. The bodhisattva was so disgusted by the unreasonableness of such sentient beings that he gave up the bodhisattva vow. However, in his life as Shariputra, it is said that Buddha Shakyamuni prophesied that Shariputra would duly become a Buddha. In more recent times, I read the biography of a very popular and famous Thai monk called Ajahn Mun. He died last century, but was much revered as an arhat, and he described a time that he was meditating in the forest and came to a stage where he could get no further. Some obstacle was preventing his meditation from progressing, and when he tried to find the cause, he saw that in a previous life he had promised to become a Buddha. This promise was now preventing him from completing his realization as an arhat. When in his mind he gave up his promise, he said immediately the obstacle was cleared and progress in his meditation practice continued. The conclusion is that, although it seems to Shantideva that logically one who goes back on the bodhisattva vow will afterwards have difficulty finding a happy rebirth, in fact, only a Buddha really knows the effect of abandoning the vow. Ordinary people can't really say. Pema Chodron says that the story about Shariputra shows the sort of unreasonable behavior we have to expect after having taken the bodhisattva vow. Contrary to leading to comfort, taking the vow leads to trouble, and we have to expect it. Still, even though Shantideva says only the Buddha knows what happens when someone gives up bodhicitta, he concludes it is the worst thing a bodhisattva can do. This for a bodhisattva, he says, is the heaviest of downfalls, for should it ever happen, the welfare of all will be weakened. Thus, although we should expect some discouragement, to totally give up the vow is the gravest mistake. Pema Chodron is always optimistic. She points out that the vow is like a golden vase. It is easily mended. So we can take the vow again and again whenever we wish, and it is never too late to start all over again. Perhaps that is what happened to Shariputra. Actually, as we've said before, there are a couple of verses that a bodhisattva can repeat every day to renew the vow, and many people who have taken the vow repeat those verses daily, three times in the morning and three times in the evening. And should others for a single moment hinder or obstruct his wholesome deeds by weakening the welfare of all, there will be no end to their rebirth in lower states. The second gravest mistake is making obstacles to or preventing a bodhisattva's efforts. And as we don't know who is a bodhisattva, we should take care of all our relationships. One highly realized lama was traveling with his attendant and some students in a car in India one day when they passed through one of those little villages that huddle throughout the country. Just outside the village, the lama made the driver of the vehicle stop and turn around. They went back to the village where a group of people were standing chatting, one of them being a young woman with a disability. The lama circumambulated the group and then went to pay respects to the woman before the travelers climbed back into the car and went on their way. When his attendant asked about the incident, the lama told him that the woman was actually an enlightened being. And the point of the story is that ordinary people like me have no idea who is highly realized or not. But it is almost certain that highly realized beings don't go around saying, "Hey, look at me, I'm enlightened." In fact, they will much more probably just appear ordinary. They may be recognized by other highly realized individuals, but I think we can be pretty sure that those who go around saying they are enlightened or have incredible realizations are not what they say they are. For if my being is impaired by destroying the joy of even one creature, then what need is there to mention destroying the joy of creatures vast as space? We all probably have memories of doing things that hurt others and that we are now very ashamed of. The incidents themselves are long gone, and the beings involved may have forgotten, but our memories and emotions still torment us. So if this is the case for harming just one being, imagine what it is like knowing that we have harmed all beings everywhere by promising to help them both temporarily and ultimately, but then turning away. In a commentary to these last three verses, His Holiness says that many factors determine whether a downfall is heavy or not. But generating wrong view and giving up aspirational bodhicitta are sufficient unto themselves. They need no other factors to incur a very weighty downfall. Thus, those who have the force of an awakening mind, as well as the force of falling from it, stay revolving within cyclic existence and for a long time are hindered in reaching the bodhisattva levels. And His Holiness goes on to say that although downfalls can be purified, it is better not to incur them, as it takes longer to achieve the higher levels of realizations once the vow is transgressed and then purified than if it hadn't been broken in the first place. However, Pema Chodron points out that it doesn't mean we will never become enlightened. In Buddhism, there's no such thing as eternal damnation. Some states of mind may seem endless, but even the worst suffering is impermanent, and a way out always exists. However, if we just keep on reinforcing old habits and creating obstacles to our ongoing evolution, our progress will slow down considerably. Automatically, we will feel increasingly restless and dissatisfied and see ourselves as procrastinators, losers, people who never get anything done. With attentiveness to karma, Pema Chodron says, we can act intelligently and use our precious human rebirth as a path to enlightenment, not to hell. I must stress, though, that we should be compassionate with ourselves. In the West, we have learned to be highly critical of ourselves, and often by extension others, and we easily get depressed if we think we have failed. This type of thinking is just more self-absorption leading to misery. It is much better not to be so judgmental, but to accept and work compassionately with our imperfections, even if they lead us to breaking our commitment. That way, we keep a relaxed mind that more easily transforms imperfection into perfection. And there I must leave you, for time is up. Thanks for joining the program today. Before we sign off, let's just take a moment to dedicate any positive potential from this program to the development of bodhicitta and keeping our commitments as well as possible. Thank you. I hope you'll be with us again next week. And until then, as Shantideva says, today in the presence of all the protectors, I invite the world to be guests at a festival of temporary and ultimate delight. May gods, anti-gods, and all be joyful. This show is brought to you by the Buddhist Youth Association every Sunday, bringing Buddhism to the community of the Waikato. We also give away a range of free English or Chinese Buddhism books, MP3, or tapes on Buddhism. If you'd like one, please send a letter with $3 worth of stamps in an envelope to P.O. Box 82146, Highland Park, Howick, Auckland. Or you can phone 09271-3377. Buddhist Youth Association, respectful, beneficial, empowering.